Hi class, it's Dr. Fields again. For this lecture, we're going to be discussing psychotic disorders. I have a couple videos that I think provide a good illustration into some of the key symptoms of these kinds of disorders, especially schizophrenia. So, as usual, take a look at those videos, and then when you're finished, come back to the audio lecture. Okay, so assuming you've watched the videos, we're now going to move on to discussing the various disorders within this category. So these are pretty severe disorders. In fact, these are very severe disorders. Some of the things that differentiate them are the intensity and definitely the duration, as you will see. Okay, there are five disorders we're going to really focus on in this category. So, moving on to slide two, we have brief psychotic disorder. Okay, so as its name entails, relative to the other psychotic disorders, this tends to be of a shorter duration. Okay, so let's look at the criteria here. Presence of one or more of the following symptoms, at least one of these must be either one, and I didn't number these here, but one being delusions, two being hallucinations, or three being disorganized speech. Note, do not include a symptom if it is a culturally sanctioned response. So if it's typical for the person's culture, as we always have that in the backdrop whenever we're discussing whether or not a symptom is abnormal, then of course that this would not apply. Okay, so I don't expect you to know these terms yet, but we're going to discuss them in greater depth. So you're talking about either hallucinations, disorganized speech, which is frequent derailment of speech or incoherence. Or grossly disorganized or catatonic behavior. Don't worry if these are not familiar to you yet, although if you're reading the textbook, maybe they would be. We're going to get into more depth in just a little while. Okay, the duration of a brief psychotic disorder episode is at least one day, but not more than one month. So between one day and one month, with eventual full return to pre-morbid level of functioning. There are a lot of different terms that you'll see that essentially are the same thing. I told you in the last lecture, baseline essentially means your normal functioning. So pre-morbid level is the level that you were at before this disorder came about, which is, again, is your normal, right? So that's the level of functioning that you had before you had this disorder, okay? And then the disturbance is not better explained by major depressive or bipolar disorder with psychotic features or another psychotic disorder such as schizophrenia, etc., etc. Then we have some specifiers here with marked stressors, which is also known as a brief reactive psychosis. If symptoms occur in response to events that singly or together would be markedly stressful to almost anyone in similar circumstances in the individual's culture, and then without marked stressors, okay? And there's a few other qualifiers there with catatonia, and we're going to discuss what catatonia means, and then also some severity indicators, okay? Okay, then we have delusional disorder. Delusional disorder is the presence of one or more delusions in particular with the duration of one month or longer. Okay, so right off the bat, the main difference between brief psychotic disorder and delusional disorder is delusional disorder lasts for more than a month, and brief psychotic disorder lasts for less than a month. The other main difference is delusional disorder is only focused on delusions. So that is the main psychotic feature, okay? Criterion A for schizophrenia, which we'll look at in a little bit, has never been met. And criterion A for schizophrenia has a lot of other different kind of psychotic features. It says, special note here, hallucinations can be present with this disorder, but they're not prominent. That means they don't really, stand out as the key symptom and are related to the delusional theme. So in other words, if there are hallucinations, they're related to whatever the theme of the delusion is. So, for example, if the person has the sensation of being infested with insects, that's his or her delusion. Or rather, I should say, if the person has the delusion that they believe they are infested with insects, and then they have this tactile hallucination where they almost feel like the insects are in their body, they have this unusual perceptual disturbance, right? Then that would be fitting with that delusion. That hallucination would fit with that particular delusion. But they're not the main feature. The delusion is a main feature of this disorder. Apart from the impact of the delusion or its ramifications, functioning is not markedly impaired, and behavior is not obviously bizarre or odd. So, in other words, these people kind of blend in with society. They look pretty normal, otherwise, in terms of the behavior and everything else, until, you're having a conversation with them and this kind of comes up, and then all of a sudden you realize that, oh, wow, this person has a serious thought disorder here. Okay? And so, because it's such a specific kind of disorder, it when the person is under the delusion, it certainly will impact their functioning. But otherwise, they look very normal. In terms of if you pass them on the street or have an informal kind of conversation with them, they wouldn't strike you as being odd unless you talked with them long enough to discover they had this unusual thought process. If manic or major depressive episodes have occurred, these have been brief relative to the duration of the delusional period. So, in other words, these have to be in excess of any kind of mood episode. And there's our rule out, it's not due to a substance or medical condition or another mental disorder. And then there's some very interesting specifiers in terms of what has been found to be some common delusions that these people have. Erotomanic type is a type of delusion where the central theme is that another person is in love with the individual. This is like the kind of person that you might have heard about on the news that like breaks into Taylor Swift's house. And has this intense obsession with her, and has this delusion that, she would be receptive to this person's advances or may even, may even know this person when clearly she does not. So that would be an example in the news of somebody with that type of delusional disorder. Grandiose type. This subtype applies when the central theme of the delusion is a conviction of having some great but unrecognized talent or insight or having made some important discovery. This kind of delusional idea of specialness. Jealous type. This subtype applies when the central theme of the delusion is that his or her spouse or lover is unfaithful when all the evidence is to the contrary. Okay, and it's really like this kind of just completely unwarranted belief that their lover is being unfaithful when there's absolutely zero evidence. Okay, persecutory type. This subtype applies when the central theme of the delusion involves the individual's belief that he or she is being conspired against, cheated, spied on, followed, poisoned, or drugged, maliciously maligned, harassed. So, in other words, other people are out to get me. That is the delusion. The somatic type, this subtype applies when the central theme of the delusion involves bodily functions or sensations. This kind of delusion could be believing that somebody implanted something into their body. Mixed type has to do with when no one single delusional theme predominates, and unspecified type applies when the dominant delusional belief cannot be clearly determined. Specify if with bizarre content. Now, I know all of these sound very bizarre, but what we mean by this is that the delusions are clearly implausible, not understandable, and not derived from ordinary life experience. So they give an example. An individual believes that a stranger has removed his or her internal organs and replaced them with someone else's organs without leaving any wounds or scars. So something that could not happen, right? Impossible. Whereas a jealousy type, you know, it is possible that one's spouse or lover could be unfaithful. And I guess it could even be possible that Taylor Swift was in love with you. Okay. And then we have a bunch of these other specifiers that I'm just not going to get into because they're very clinical and just not useful for our purposes. Okay. All right. Moving on. Schizoaffective disorder. This is like a mixed bag. It's kind of like a mixed psychotic mood disorder, okay? So, this is an uninterrupted period of illness during which there is a major mood episode. So, you're talking either a major depressive episode or a full manic episode concurrent with criterion A of schizophrenia, okay? And criterion A of schizophrenia, I can tell you, has things such as hallucinations, delusions, disorganized behavior, negative symptoms, those kind of things. And we're gonna get into that in just a second. Also, delusions or hallucinations must be present, those particular symptoms, for 2 or more weeks in the absence of a major mood episode during the lifetime during the duration of the illness. So, in other words, that delusions or hallucinations need to be present during times where the person is not experiencing the symptoms of a mood episode. Okay? Now, one of the things I will say here, what differentiates schizoaffective disorder from bipolar disorder with psychotic features, we know that a manic episode many times can present with psychotic features and even some depressive episodes. So, what differentiates this is that these symptoms occur not only during the mood disturbance or the mood episode, but during times when the mood episode is not present. Okay? And also that unlike bipolar disorder with psychotic features, where you might only have one psychotic feature, such as a grandiose delusion or something like this, schizoaffective disorder will have at least a couple of these different kinds of psychotic symptoms. So those are some of the main differences, in case you were wondering. Symptoms that meet criteria for a major mood episode are present for the majority of the total duration of the active and residual portions of the illness. So while there are times where these psychotic features are present when the mood disorder is not present, the majority of the time they occur during the mood disturbance. Okay? And the disturbance is not attributable to the effects of a substance or medical condition, etc., etc., etc. There's that rule out. By the way, if you were wondering what residual meant, active and residual, active means the, you know, you're experiencing the full-blown criteria of the disorder. In other words, you're meeting criteria, the full criteria for the disorder. And residual means when only a few symptoms that are very mild, that are subclinical, they don't totally meet criteria for the disorder. And I've mentioned this before with a lot of the different disorders. You know, just because a person is bipolar doesn't mean they're always manic. Just because a person has major depressive disorder or even dysthymia doesn't mean they're always depressed. There are periods when they're not. And so is with this. There are periods when they don't experience any symptoms, or they will experience only some few mild kind of a symptoms. And then, of course, there must be times where they experience the full-blown criteria, because otherwise they wouldn't meet the criteria for diagnosis. Okay, we have some specifiers here. Is this a bipolar type in which there are manic episodes present and often major depressive episodes as well, or purely a depressive type where it's only depressive episodes? With catatonia is another specifier. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. Okay, and those other specifiers just aren't that important for our purposes. If you were in a clinical psychology training program, I'd say you'd absolutely have to know them, but not for this. Okay. So now we're going to go to schizophreniform disorder. Okay. And that is, just in case you're wondering, we're on slide 5 here. So schizophreniform disorder is very similar to schizophrenia, with some subtle but important differences. So, two or more of the following have to be present for a significant portion of time during a 1 month period, or less if they've been successfully treated by medication. And at least one of these must be either symptoms 1, 2, or 3: delusions, hallucinations, or disorganized speech. Okay? The episode of the disorder lasts at least 1 month, but less than 6 months. When the diagnosis must be made without waiting for recovery, it should be qualified as provisional. Don't worry about that. Schizoaffective disorder and depressive or bipolar disorder with psychotic features have been ruled out because either no major depressive or manic episodes have occurred concurrently with these active phase symptoms. Or if mood episodes have occurred during active phase symptoms, they have been present for a minority of the total duration of the active and residual periods of the illness. So in other words, these symptoms really have to be existent, not just during times of some kind of mood disturbance. Okay, and we have criterion D, our rule out, and some specifiers there. We see with catatonia is another specifier. I'm sure you're all eager to know what that's about. And the note at the bottom: diagnosis of schizophreniform disorder can be made without using the severity specifiers. Those severity specifiers, in fact, for all the disorders, I'm not that interested in you knowing. Like I said, that's more for like a graduate clinical psychology course. Okay, so now we're going to go to the last one. And this is kind of like the granddaddy of all psychological disorders. What I mean by that is, this is kind of like the worst one in many regards. The category of psychotic disorders already has a connotation that these are some pretty serious conditions because they have some serious symptoms. And so within this category, this is the most serious one. And it's very debilitating. I'm sure you've seen some movies on it. There was that famous movie, A Beautiful Mind, right? So, there's so many different movies about this. And just because people are just fascinated by schizophrenia. Just because it is such a debilitating mental illness. So let's see what the difference is between schizophrenia and schizophreniform disorder, because they're close. You'll see criterion A is virtually the same. Two or more of the following, each present for a significant portion of time during a 1 month period, or less if successfully treated. And here we have the same kind of psychotic symptoms: delusions, hallucinations, disorganized speech, grossly disorganized or catatonic behavior, and negative symptoms. Okay? For a significant portion of the time since the onset of the disturbance, level of functioning in one or more major areas, such as work, interpersonal relations, or self-care, is markedly below the level achieved prior to the onset. So there's our first difference. These symptoms tend to be, or the manifestation of this disorder rather, tends to be more severe in regards to its impact on one's life functioning. So these symptoms tend to be more intense. There tends to be a lot more associated symptoms that really have this collective impact on one's functioning, much more so than schizophreniform disorder. Okay? And the second key difference is, in criterion C, continuous signs of the disturbance persist for at least 6 months. So schizophreniform disorder goes from 1 month to 6 months. This is for 6 months or more. So, for the ones who are really thinking right now, you might already be jumping to the correct conclusion that lots of times people will initially be diagnosed with schizophreniform disorder, and then all of a sudden, after the 6 month mark, the symptoms start to have a more severe impact on their functioning, and the symptoms are now progressing beyond the 6 month mark, so therefore, the new diagnosis would be schizophrenia. Okay? So it's possible to have schizophreniform disorder and never have it turn into or morph into schizophrenia, but it certainly is quite common for what a clinician initially thinks is schizophreniform disorder is really schizophrenia. Okay? And then we have that rule out there about schizoaffective disorder and depressive or bipolar disorder with psychotic features not being ruled out, right? And our other rule out that this is not due to a drug or medical condition. And then because schizophrenia and a lot of these psychotic disorders shares some very unusual symptoms, just like autism spectrum disorder, there's a special caveat here for that in criterion F. It says if there's a history of autism spectrum disorder, the additional diagnosis of schizophrenia can be made, but only if prominent delusions or hallucinations are present in addition to the other required symptoms of schizophrenia. Okay? All right. Okay, so I like presenting the videos and I like talking about the criteria for the different disorders, so that there's a lot of terminology that you're not quite sure about, but you're being exposed to it. And then what I like to do, as you've probably noticed from a lot of my other lectures, and then go back and talk about these in more depth, which we're going to do in just 1 second. But before we do that, I just want to show you the prevalence rates for some of these disorders. So we have prevalence rates that are pretty well established by the research. For delusional disorder, the lifetime prevalence rate is estimated to be about 0.024 to 0.06%. So that's very, very rare. Schizophreniform disorder, the lifetime prevalence rate is estimated to be around 0.2%. And schizophrenia, the lifetime prevalence rate worldwide is estimated to be around 0.2 to 1.5%. And similar rates for males and females. So, pretty rare disorders. So, going on to slide 8, whenever I talk about psychotic disorders, I like to talk about the early dichotomous classification system that we used to have. So, way back when, in Freud's time, and sometime after that, there basically was two types of diagnoses. You either had a neurosis or a psychosis, and that was it. So there wasn't, all this differentiation in terms of an anxiety disorder, depressive disorder, obsessive compulsive related disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder. It was either you had a neurosis or a psychosis. And in some ways, I think that dichotomy is still helpful today, in terms of trying to show that there is, a very firm distinction between, the psychotic disorders such as schizophrenia and all of the other disorders. So, for example, with the neuroses or the non-psychotic disorders like anxiety, depression, basically all the disorders we've talked about up until now, the person knows the difference between what is real and what is not. We can say they have distorted or irrational thinking, but their thinking is not, completely off or, downright false, right? And they understand the difference between what is real and what is not real. They could have some exaggerated kinds of beliefs that, are not so accurate, but that is a far cry from just being completely false, right? So, psychosis or psychoses and psychotic disorders, this is where a person has what we call poor reality testing. Poor reality testing is a clinical phrase that means a person does not have good ability for differentiating what is real from what is not real, okay? And they have what we would call disordered thought, okay? Which involves false beliefs and or perception, false beliefs or false perceptions, disordered perceptions. Okay, so now that you know the general difference between these disorders and the other ones, let's talk more in depth about some of these kinds of disordered thoughts and perceptions. The disordered thoughts and perceptions fall under the category of positive symptoms. And I know that almost sounds like a misnomer, right? There's nothing positive about them. But positive meaning that it's the presence of these symptoms. Positive, if going back to math, right? A positive is connotated by a plus sign, right? So a plus meaning adding, right? So these symptoms have been added to the person's life, right? In a sense, and that's why we call them positive symptoms. The negative symptoms are symptoms that are not present. The person is not doing these symptoms, not doing these things, and they should be. Okay, so that's the difference. That's why we call them positive and negative. They're all negative, right? Or unhealthy. But positive meaning there's an existence of symptoms, and there is a non-existence of certain behaviors that should be there for normal functioning. So these kinds of disordered thoughts and perceptions fall into the category of positive symptoms. And basically, when we're talking about disordered perceptions, we're talking about hallucinations or perceptual disturbances is another way I like to view them because they are disturbing a person's accurate perception of the world. They're interfering with an accurate perception of the world. Perception is another word for, or perceptual is another word for sensory, right? So, in other words, it comes from the word perceiving, right? How do we perceive our environment, right? How do we know about our environment? Well, through the five senses, right? We have vision, hearing, olfactory sense, which is smelling, tactile sense, which is feeling, and gustatory sense, which is taste. Those are the five ways that we interact with the environment, right? And understand the environment or are aware of the environment. So different from like depersonalization, derealization disorder, where there's definitely some perceptual abnormalities or anomalies or what have you. The person with depersonalization, derealization disorder still knows that what they're experiencing is not real, right? They know that it's not real and the symptoms are not as intense as with hallucinations. Hallucinations are pretty intense. So these can, or I should say, these usually are visual, in which the person is seeing things that are not real, or auditory, hearing things that are not real. Okay, so either seeing things like, they're seeing like a dog run across that path that's not even real, that's not even there, or they're hearing something like like a voice, right? Talking to them or something of that nature. So delusions are another type of psychotic symptom, which are disordered thoughts that are not based on reality. So these are completely false beliefs, not rooted in any facts or actual experience, and two that are very common, especially in schizophrenia, are grandiose delusions, which a person believes that he or she is very special in some way. They might believe that they're a superhero or Jesus Christ or some person with special abilities. Or they can be persecutory, where they believe a person or group of people are out to get them, right? That's also a common delusion. Okay? All right. Negative symptoms, they're negative in the sense that they're a symptom because the person is not doing something. It's a lack of doing something that they should be doing. So these are more or less like associated symptoms, right? The real psychotic symptoms are hallucinations and delusions, the positive symptoms. But these are also very severe symptoms as well that are associated with some of these disorders, especially schizophrenia. Avolition is the disinterest in or greatly reduced ability for performing daily living and self-care tasks. They just don't take care of themselves. Very similar to people with very severe depression, right? That may not take care of themselves very well because they're very depressed. Alogia, which is a disinterest in or greatly reduced ability for speaking, so they become almost mute and nonverbal. Anhedonia, which is also common to depression, is an inability to derive pleasure from experiences, so therefore they don't seek out pleasurable activities, right? Asociality, similar, but in the sense of social interaction, there's a disinterest in people and interacting with them. So they're very withdrawn. If you're looking at all these kinds of symptoms, they're not motivated, they're very withdrawn. And then we have flat affect, which is blunted and greatly reduced emotional expressiveness. So again, very withdrawn, not much emotional response, not much of an emotional response. They're not speaking much, they're not doing many things, okay? And by the way, these symptoms fluctuate just like with any disorder. It's not like these people, are constantly bombarded with hallucinations all the time, or they're always behaving in these kinds of ways. It's just that for a large majority of the time they are, especially with the more severe kinds of disorders. Okay, and then if you go on to slide 10, some other types of symptoms are these disorganized symptoms, which are very common, again, especially with schizophrenia. Disorganized speech. This is a word salad. They speak, when they do speak, they speak words often that make absolutely no sense, or the sentences they put together are just nonsense sentences. They make absolutely no sense, and they can even use what are called neologisms, which are basically made up words, or just, illogical verbalizations. So it's just kind of these random verbalizations that don't make any sense. They also, when we're talking about disorganized speech, can have a tendency to engage in what we call tangential speech, which is a fancy way of saying going off on a tangent. So if you ask them a question, they'll either start to answer it and then just, start to talk about a completely different topic that's completely unrelated, or they'll do that initially. Or they'll jump from one topic or idea to another very abruptly, which we see a lot of times with manics too. They also have inappropriate affect, and this is emotional expression that does not fit with the situation. So, for example, laughing when someone is discussing something that really is upsetting to them, right? And disorganized behavior, acting in a very strange way that can include wearing very eccentric or unusual clothes, or just very odd behaviorisms. And included in this is catatonia. So we're finally going to talk about catatonia, that term that just kept popping up. What is catatonia? Well, catatonia is a cluster of symptoms. It's really not a separate disorder, but it's more a cluster of symptoms that many schizophrenics or people with severe psychotic disorders will have. And it involves three or more of the following types of symptoms: stupor, which is no psychomotor activity, not actively relating to the environment, so they act as if they're paralyzed. Catalepsy is a passive induction of a posture held against gravity, so they're just kind of like, frozen in this one posture, right, in a very passive way. Waxy flexibility is when they give slight, even resistance to positioning by the examiner. They just kind of like allow themselves to get repositioned if the examiner tries. We do these different tests with them just to see the level of catatonia. So sometimes an examiner will manipulate their body in different ways to see how they react. Mutism is no or very little verbal response, not due to aphasia, which is a language disorder. In other words, they're choosing not to talk. Negativism is an opposition or no response to instructions or external stimuli, so just a failure to heed any directives. Posturing is spontaneous and active maintenance of a posture against gravity. So just kind of moving into a different posture and holding it spontaneously, and then maybe switching again into another posture and holding it. And these postures are usually very odd kinds of postures that they're in. Also odd mannerisms that they can have. Stereotypy, which is repetitive, abnormally frequent, non-goal-directed movements. We see this a lot in children with autism, with hand flapping, those kind of like repetitive motor movements. And agitation, not influenced by external stimuli, grimacing, just making giant smiles for no reason, or different facial expressions for no reasons. And echolalia, mimicking another's speech, or echopraxia, mimicking another's movements. So, they'll possibly imitate the examiner's movements or another person's movements. So it's very odd behavior, really, for lack of a better way of saying it, right? Very odd, strange physical behavior. Okay, now we're going to spend some time talking specifically about schizophrenia. And everything that we discuss up to this point is all different symptoms of schizophrenia. On slide 12, I want to discuss the typical course of schizophrenia, the development of schizophrenia. So this disorder is usually precipitated by a prodromal stage lasting between 1 to 2 years. So, in other words, they don't just usually develop full-blown schizophrenia. There's usually a prodromal stage that a lot of times people will will think is really schizophreniform disorder, and then will eventually find out that no, they really have schizophrenia. So the prodromal stage lasts between 1 to 2 years, and about 85%, so the large majority of all schizophrenics will experience this. And it will include subclinical or relatively mild symptoms that can last from 2 to 10 years and include ideas of reference, which is believing insignificant events relate to them. So if, people are walking by and they're talking in a group, they may think that they're talking about them. Magical thinking, believing they have special abilities, like they might believe like they can read minds. Illusions, feeling the presence of an other when alone. Feeling like they believe someone else is in the room. So, these are like subclinical psychotic features. They're not like full blown, right? So there's definitely a difference between feeling like someone is in the room as opposed to seeing somebody, an actual person in the room, as in a visual hallucination, right? And believing a special ability like maybe reading minds or predicting the future is definitely very different than, or not nearly as severe as thinking that aliens have taken control of them, right? So these are milder psychotic-like symptoms that is going to last within this prodromal stage from about 1 to 2 years. Also, during this time, they can be socially withdrawn, fail to maintain adaptive or self-help or self-care behaviors, basically letting themselves go, right, for lack of a better way of saying it, and can lack motivation and interest in pleasurable activities. So these are the kinds of symptoms that usually are present before they, have full-blown schizophrenia. Okay, moving on to slide 13, talking about some of the causes. Well, the biological evidence, there is quite a bit of it, and it really leads us to believe that schizophrenia is either mostly a biological condition or fully a biological condition. So there has been evidence to show that people with schizophrenia, that there is a strong genetic predisposition or susceptibility for developing, in general, a psychotic disorder, not just schizophrenia, but that there is this strong genetic predisposition to developing these kinds of disorders. It's also been found that people with schizophrenia have eye tracking deficits. And this is interesting. Eye tracking has to do with your ability to track, right, with your eye. Like, in other words, just thinking about that DUI test where the police officer will take a light and make you follow the light with your eyes, right? That's like an eye tracking test. So they have difficulty tracking with their eye, and that's interesting because I thought, well, that may be evidence of a difficulty in perception, which would make them more vulnerable to perceptual disturbances such as possibly hallucinations and what have you, okay? Or it could just be an associated unusual trait that just happens to be associated with schizophrenia. And there's some other reason for why it's associated with it that we don't know. So that's just some guesswork there. But that's another piece of biological evidence that we've found. We've also found that people with schizophrenia tend to have abnormal levels of dopamine and glutamate, sorry, which are two neurotransmitters in different areas of the brain. There has also been some evidence for various brain structure abnormalities, including some of the ventricles, as well as the prefrontal cortex, the thalamus, and basal ganglia. So they have all been found to have some structural abnormalities. In addition, many schizophrenics have been found to have been exposed to viral and other infections during pregnancy, as well as have had perinatal or delivery complications such as asphyxia, which is a loss of oxygen, possibly from being tangled up with the umbilical cord. So that's also been found to be related to schizophrenia. So it's a lot of biological evidence there, okay? So going on to the psychological causes, if there are psychological causes, then we're under the assumption that they combine with these biological vulnerabilities or susceptibilities, but not that psychological causes would be in and by themselves enough to cause schizophrenia. We really don't think that. We could be proven wrong in the future, but there just doesn't seem to be enough evidence for that. The evidence that we do have is that stressors, especially if they're severe enough, can lead to the initiation or onset of symptoms. So in other words, if you have schizophrenia, then, you are more vulnerable to the effects of stressors, and if you go through a certain stressful period of your life, you're more apt to experience these psychotic symptoms. And certainly, stressors can definitely exacerbate these conditions and symptoms. But again, we're just not so sure, or there's lacking evidence that they cause schizophrenia. It does seem more of a biological condition. Psychodynamic therapy, in terms of early psychodynamic therapy, particularly classical psychoanalysis, so we're talking about Freud, theorized that people developed schizophrenia because of their mother. So that's where psychodynamic therapy kind of started to get a bad rap for always blaming the mother. The original conceptualization was that a mother who had traits such as being cold, domineering, and rejecting, was referred to as being schizophrenogenic and was thought of as being responsible for causing this disorder in her child. This theory has been discredited, and there's absolutely no evidence to support this. And then family and systems therapy, early family and systems therapy theory, particularly Bateson's, similarly blamed the parents, not just the mother, but both parents, for causing schizophrenia as well. And in his theory, Bateson's theory, he purported that parents used a what was called a double bind communication style that involved two conflicting messages. So one message was verbal and the other was nonverbal, and that they conflicted. So like the verbal message would be like, come here and give mom and dad a hug, and when the child goes to hug his mom or dad, they kind of like stiffen up as if they don't want to be hugged. So it's like this conflicting message, like, I want your affection, I don't want your affection. And so that was purported to, in essence, cause, or be crazy making, right? That having experienced constantly these contradictory messages that they believe led to the development of schizophrenia. This has also been debunked and discredited. There's no evidence for that. However, what they have found in family therapy studies is highly, especially family therapy studies of schizophrenics, is highly emotionally volatile families, highly emotional families, right? And we're talking about negative emotionality, who tend to criticize and blame the patient for the severity of his or her condition, definitely have been found to be related to higher relapse rates and poorer prognoses for schizophrenics. So, this kind of dysfunctional family certainly can lead to this condition being worse. Families can make every condition worse. You know that, right? Like any dysfunctional family can make a psychological condition worse. Okay, so how do we treat schizophrenia and some of these other psychotic disorders? Well, with medications such as antipsychotics. Okay, so in parentheses are the brand names of these different medications. We have Thorazine, Haldol, Abilify, Zyprexa, Seroquel, and Risperdal. You'll notice that some of these medications are also used to treat the manic episodes in bipolar illness. That makes sense because the manic episodes in bipolar illness, a lot of times present with a psychotic feature, okay? And certainly are pretty severe, right? So the problem with these medications isn't that they don't work. They definitely work. The problem is that patients really don't like to take these medications. And as severe as schizophrenia is, these medications can be pretty intolerable. So they have very bad side effects that a lot of these people don't like. They kind of feel like they're zombies. You know, they're basically heavy duty tranquilizers, and they can lead to some pretty bad motor side effects. Two in particular are akinesia, which is greatly impaired and reduced motor functioning. So in other words, you know, their physical functioning, you know, being able to use their hands or what have you, or you know, their muscles is compromised to some degree. Or they can develop tardive dyskinesia, which is really the worst situation. Because this situation is often permanent and it involves involuntary motor movements, which basically are tics. So, in other words, these medications could lead to a person having tardive dyskinesia, which is essentially just like Tourette's, which is, you know, having these tics that they can't control, that even after the medication is discontinued, still last for the rest of their lives, pretty much. So, you know, those are some pretty negative things with the medications, which is why a lot of these patients don't want to take them. Now, I will say this: the newer medications are much less likely to produce some of these really bad side effects. And their side effect profile, as we refer to it, is not as bad as the older drugs, but there's still some heavy-duty medication with some not so desirable side effects, and it's unfortunate. The other medical treatment that has been found to be effective with these psychotic disorders, particularly for reducing auditory hallucinations in terms of hearing things that aren't there, is transcranial magnetic stimulation. And this is basically stimulating the brain by use of magnetic force. But that only seems to reduce auditory hallucinations, not all the other symptoms. But of course, you know, if you had that, and then you were on an antipsychotic medication that, let's say, you didn't experience such bad side effects, you know, that could be an effective treatment for you. And then, of course, even though we don't believe that schizophrenia is solely due to psychological causes, and many of us believe that psychological influence do not even play a big role in schizophrenia. Psychological interventions, just like with the neurocognitive disorders, certainly can help quite a bit. So, cognitive behavioral therapy in particular can be helpful in terms of teaching schizophrenics how to recognize the early warning signs or cues that they are going to have a full-blown episode. Just like we talked about with, like, for example, manic episode, bipolar illness. Just because you have bipolar disorder doesn't mean you're gonna always be in a manic episode, right? In fact, you never are always in a manic episode. There are periods where you're in a manic episode and periods where you're functioning normally. Schizophrenics, it's the same thing. There are some periods where they're functioning normally or they're only experiencing mild subclinical symptoms, okay? So we can teach them, certain cues or hints, to be on the lookout for that signal, uh-oh, the full-blown psychotic disorder is going to hit. And so they can have, pretty much be able to do a preemptive strike against it, maybe by, being prescribed another kind of medication, or, more intensive therapy during that time, or some other kinds of proactive measures to deal with it, okay? Now, that old adage, if you don't use it, you lose it, right? So a lot of times, especially with these negative symptoms we talked about, where they're not very verbal, they're not interacting with people, they're very withdrawn, they tend to be socially deficient, because they're not engaging in social interaction as much as the rest of us. Their social skills are subpar. So another thing we can do with cognitive behavioral therapy is reteach them social skills, okay, to make sure that their social skills are appropriate. Cognitive remediation. Again, when you're checking out for long periods of time, if you don't use it, you lose it, right? So some of your cognitive abilities are going to be compromised. So we can do some cognitive remediation tasks to help, support their cognitive ability in the same kind of way that we did with people with neurocognitive disorders like Alzheimer's disease, right? We can also teach them coping skills and compensatory strategies for dealing with some of these different kinds of symptoms. And we can definitely play a big role in reinforcing medication compliance. When they don't want to take their medication, we really want them to understand the impact of that. And while the side effects can be severe and unpleasant, the alternative is much worse. Also, we can dispute disordered thoughts, right? They may have irrational and distorted thoughts, like a lot of neurotic people, but certainly we can also dispute their disordered thoughts, and help them distinguish between what is real and what is not real, even with their perceptions, helping them identify what's a hallucination and what's not. Over time, they tend to have very similar kinds of delusions and hallucinations, and so, you can teach them to, look at the evidence and to be able to say, all right, this kind of hallucination that you've had so many times before, be on the lookout for. If you do see this or hear this thing, right, it's probably false. And to not get too, to not be so reactive to it. So we can teach them, in essence, to have better reality testing. Okay, so even though they're experiencing psychotic symptoms, doesn't mean that we can't help them better distinguish, when, you know, being able to identify when they're experiencing these symptoms from reality. Okay? And then also, you know, when they have some of these unusual kinds of perceptual experiences, these hallucinations, teaching them to ignore them. Like, okay, so, you know, you have this typical hallucination where you see this alien sitting in the chair across from you. You know from history that this is common for you to think that or to have this hallucination. So, you know, recognize it for what it is if you can, and don't give it any mind to it, you know? Okay, whatever. You know, there's an alien sitting on a chair over there, whatever. And ACT techniques, which we mentioned way back when, are a particular type of cognitive behavioral therapy intervention. It's called acceptance and commitment therapy techniques, and they can be very helpful because they teach a person how to deal with disturbing thoughts, ideas, and can teach a person how to deal with disturbing visual images and hallucinations and auditory kinds of hallucinations, and just to kind of not react to them and be more tolerant of them and just kind of withstand them, so to speak. Now, as we said before, a dysfunctional family certainly can make the symptoms worse and the prognosis worse. So, family and systems therapy can definitely have an important role in terms of helping the family function in a healthier manner to reduce a high level of emotional volatility, sorry, and to help the family learn not to blame the patient for his or her conditions. So it's almost like an educational intervention. And I mentioned psychodynamic therapy only to say it has been shown to have very little effectiveness in schizophrenia. Drug therapy and practical kinds of therapy, teaching practical skills like cognitive behavioral therapy, are the best bet for these kinds of conditions. Okay, all right. So next time I will, yeah, next time you hear from me, we will be going over personality disorders, which are equally fascinating. Till then, stay safe and be well.